Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. If you've ever had the pleasure of getting a teenager out of bed in time for school, then this scene from the 1982 teen classic Fast Times at Ridgemont High might sound a little familiar.
Dad says you have to get up.
Leave me alone.
Dad says you're going to be late again, you booger. Dad, Jeff runs not clapping.
As it turns out, Jeff Spicoli might have had a biological argument for why he should have been allowed to sleep in just a little bit more. Jessica Leahy is an educator and contributing writer to The Atlantic, where she recently wrote about the debate over school start times. And Jessica joins us now on Word of Mouth. Hi.
Hi.
So the American Academy of Pediatrics released a new policy statement about the importance of getting enough sleep specifically for teenagers. Now, what did they say? And any surprises in there?
There really weren't any surprises for people who have been following the research. They just decided to take the vast body of research on adolescent sleep and on the impact that changing start times can have on kids and compiled that in one report and then issued a policy statement based on that.
What ages are we talking about and how much sleep do we think these teenagers need?
Well, teenagers need at least 9.5 hours of sleep a night. And when I go speak at schools, they just laugh. They really do laugh at that. They say there's just no way that's going to happen. And part of the reason that can't happen is that they have a really different biological system than we do in terms of how their brains respond to their need for sleep. They have two things. They have a sleep delay. Melatonin doesn't get released in their brains until later on at night. And they also have a different sense of their own fatigue. They don't feel the sleep pressure in the way younger kids and adults feel that sleep pressure, that I haven't gotten enough sleep. I really need to go to sleep now.
So you're saying that they're sort of biologically hardwired to be night owls?
They absolutely are.
And are we talking 11 through 19, or is there a more focused age that we're talking about here?
It really varies from kid to kid. You know, when we use the term adolescent, that has shifted over time and is very different based on the population you're talking about, kid to kid.
I would guess that the obvious reason to do this is that we're worried about kids' academic performance. But did they mention any other reasons that it's really important that kids are getting this sleep? I mean, what are the downsides to getting not enough?
Well, there's a lot of things that have been looked at in the 15 school districts that have changed their school start times by an hour. We've seen some really interesting results. We've seen a decline in mood disorders. We've seen a decline in inattentiveness. One of the big things that I am a big fan of is we've seen a reduction in the rate of adolescent car accidents, kids
oh, wow.
who are involved in car accidents. But then we see an increase in testing scores. We see an increase in the, again, attentiveness. And we see overall the kids seem to report better moods, better behavior.
Okay, well, what about, and I'm sure there's a lot of people out there thinking this, the argument that maybe we're coddling our kids here. I mean, when we talk about toddlers getting enough sleep, it's with this understanding that they're not old enough to make those decisions for themselves. But for older teenagers anyway, I get the sense that maybe we want our students to start learning what they need and trying to take care of that themselves.
Absolutely, and I'm a big fan of that. The problem is with teenagers, because of this delayed melatonin release at night, it's not that they don't want to go to sleep. It's not that they're saying, oh, I really need to get my homework done earlier and get myself to bed. But because of this delayed melatonin response, they simply don't get sleepy until later than adults and children do. And that makes it so that no matter what we do, they're going to have a naturally later bedtime.
Okay, so what time are we talking about starting school then? What is the recommendation? 8:30, 9 o'clock? I mean, it could go anywhere.
Well, the 8 o'clock right now is the average start time across the country, and the American Academy of Pediatrics is recommending no earlier than 8:30. But they also say for kids that have really long commute times, schools are going to have to look at that independently and see how those commute times affect starting time for school. But 8:30 right now is the time that they're putting down as the absolute earliest to start school.
And what do you think parents have to say about this whole mess?
The emails I've been getting have been just really interesting. Number one, parents are saying, well, what happens to after school stuff? Mm. You know, what's going to happen to sports? What's going to happen to activities? But most parents are saying, absolutely, it is a nightmare to get my kid out of bed at 6 o'clock in the morning so they can catch the bus at 7 so that school can start at 7:30, 7:45. So there's been a lot of support from parents.
You've been following education for a long time. You're an educator yourself. Do you think there's any chance that these recommendations are going to get adopted? Or do you think schools are maybe too overwhelmed by curricula and just the inertia of earlier start times to make any changes whatsoever?
I'm going to be watching really carefully. I think the American Academy of Pediatrics has a lot of weight behind their recommendations. It's based on really good research. I hope school administrators pay attention. Parents are saying that they're forwarding this story on to their administrators, their teachers, their superintendents, and hopefully it'll make a change.
Well, Jessica, thank you so much for coming in and talking to us about
it. You're very welcome.
Jessica Leahy is a contributing writer to The Atlantic. You can find her article, Students Aren't Getting Enough Sleep, Schools Start Too Early. That's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Well, if school start times are delayed, all the more opportunity for young, budding minds to dream. For a long time, the study of dreams was relegated to the fringes of mysticism and pseudoscience. But in the 1970s, a man named Stephen LaBerge gained a kernel of credibility for his research on lucid dreaming. That is, when a dreamer becomes aware that he or she is in fact asleep. Dorian Ralston is a freelance writer covering cognitive science, mental health, and the mind. His article on the work of Stephen LaBerge and on new efforts to understand lucid dreaming appeared in the online publication Matter. Virginia spoke to him about the phenomenon.
So let's talk about this experience of lucid dreaming. What is it?
Well, the definition is quite straightforward, but it's subtle. Lucid dreaming is simply being aware that you're dreaming while you're dreaming. You're not creating a dream from scratch. The dream's going on. You become aware that you're dreaming or become lucid, and then it's a matter of cultivating the ability to redirect the plot as you like. And it's not an easy skill to learn, and when people begin cultivating it, it's, I guess, little surprise that the things that they choose to do and pursue in their dreams are sort of typical fantasies. You know, they might try flying, or they might try to engage in kind of erotic fantasies, or do things that just normally aren't part of their waking life. But potentially, with enough mastery over this ability to redirect your dream plot, some people report even healing psychological wounds, confronting recurrent nightmare characters, even practicing skills. Some athletes or musicians might rehearse certain practices in their dream that a few have actually reported have resulted in real gains in waking life.
Given what we now know or can study about brain science, do we know what is happening in the brain when a person is lucid dreaming?
One thing that we've found is that the frontal lobes appear to be activated the moment that someone becomes lucid in a dream. And these frontal areas of the brain are typically associated with executive functions, such as long-term planning, memory, even self-reflection, which coheres with the way lucid dreamers report the experience. And the way we're able to do this science now is really a methodology that goes back to the late 1970s, Stephen LaBerge doing his graduate work at Stanford.
Tell us about this Stephen LaBerge, the man you describe as the founding father of lucid dreaming.
So Stephen LaBerge was the first sleep scientist to publish empirical proof of a lucid dream. And what he was doing at Stanford in the late 1970s was utilizing a recent discovery of his advisor, William Dement, about rapid eye movements. Rapid eye movements had been known to be associated with the most vivid moments of dreaming during the night. So his advisor, William Dement, discovered that these eye movements weren't always random. Sometimes they actually conformed to the content of the dream. For example, he noticed in one case, eye movements were shifting left, right, left, right, left, right. And he thought that the pattern was too deliberate to be completely random. So he woke the subject up, asked the subject what they were dreaming about, and lo and behold, they reported dreaming about a ping pong match. So LaBerge figured that if these involuntary eye movements conform to the content of an ordinary dream, then voluntary eye movements could conform to the content of a lucid dream in which you gain control over the dream. So he took himself as the first subject and went to sleep in the lab, tethered to all this polysomnographic equipment, measuring the electrical activity given off by his eyes and his brain and other muscles throughout his body. And in the early morning hours, there was a very definitive sign on the recording equipment that he was signaling to his lab technician that he had awakened in his dream.
We're speaking with Dorian Rolston. He wrote about the work of Stephen LaBerge, a pioneer in the study of lucid dreaming, who now holds workshops in lucid dreaming in Hawaii, which all, Dorian, makes it sound very new agey, you know, interesting, but you know, there you are in Hawaii going to have lucid dream workshops, learning how to do it. Did it work for you?
Well, it's a very dreamy location. And that's not coincidental. Unfortunately, it had very little impact on my dream life, and for that matter, on most of the attendees. I think we were all quite frustrated that we would show up every morning kind of bleary-eyed and hoping that someone would report some very elaborate, life-changing lucid dream, and it just never happened.
Is the idea that you could get better at it? I mean, with practice?
Yes. It's certainly a skill that needs to be developed over time. Usually there's a little bit of beginner's luck involved, where just the idea of becoming lucid in a dream is so enthralling that often the first time you discover lucid dreaming, you become lucid that night. But to become lucid on a regular basis is really something that takes a lot of practice.
But now it is being more accepted, or at least studied, by academics and scientists. Yet LaBerge himself is still considered a fringy character. Why is that?
Well, for one thing, he didn't pursue a conventional tenure track. He published his seminal study discovering that lucid dreamers could be empirically verified. And he struggled a lot to convince his colleagues not only that this was a real phenomenon, but also that it was a phenomenon worthy of study. At the time, sleep science was changing paths and funding was being diverted to clinical studies rather than so-called pure research on states of consciousness. And LaBerge didn't want to compromise his interests, so he found another way to continue studying lucid dreaming, which was to hold these workshops, which would fund his research privately and would also generate experimental subjects in the form of attendees at these workshops, of which I was one this past September.
And what did you walk away thinking, that this is genuine science or a little bit more mystical?
I think the peer-reviewed science on lucid dreaming is genuine. I think it's illuminating interesting things about consciousness. I think it's still a very new science. I mean, this is only in the past 5 years that a lot of these insights have come to light. So it'll take replication. It'll take a number of years and certainly more subjects. Right now, we only have a handful of lucid dreams as our data points from which to draw these conclusions. So it'll take some time to corroborate these findings. But as far as the peer-reviewed literature is concerned, I'm convinced that it's significant and certainly rigorous. As far as what LaBerge is doing in Hawaii, it's difficult to say. He claims that he's amassed reams of data over decades of running these workshops with hundreds of data points of lucid dreams that have happened in Hawaii or before that when he ran the workshops on Stanford's campus. But none of it has been analyzed, and certainly none of it has been published. So it's difficult to say exactly what we're going to learn from that data that he's gathered. But he promises that it's going to overturn some of these new findings that are coming to light now. But we'll have to wait and see.
Dorian, are you still trying to practice lucid dreaming?
I certainly am. I think now that I'm returning to a regular sleep schedule, not being quite so pressed on deadline, I'm going to devote myself a little more to seeing how far I can cultivate this skill. I don't think I'm one of the naturally prodigious lucid dreamers, as LaBerge or others seem to be. Some of the folks that I've spoken to really are able to concoct quite elaborate, vivid scenarios in their dreams that I only get the chance to see in the movies.
Freelance writer Dorian Rolston there, speaking with Virginia Prescott about lucid dreaming. You can find a link to his article for the online publication Matter at wordofmouthradio.org. Up next, a look at the dreams that happen when we're awake. Some people fantasize about becoming a doctor, a professional athlete, or a rock star. We'll hear the story of a woman who's living her lifelong dream playing music on the street. That's when Word of Mouth continues after a short break. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia Prescott. For some musicians, busking, or playing music on the street, is just the first step towards a music career. For Marsha Mello, it's a lifelong dream come true, and something she's had to fight for. Mallory Falk brings us her story.
Marsha Mello is hard to miss. She's textbook free spirit, two long braids, velvet pants, a plastic daffodil pinned to her cap. Marsha sings and plays slide guitar on Commercial Street in Provincetown.
I think people say my music is happy music. It's not like sad, melancholy, bring you down stuff.
Marsha started busking 10 years ago, but she's been playing guitar for most of her life.
My fingers were so sore. The first day I played, I put masking tape on the fingers and kept playing. But I always loved the sound of it. I guess the strings was for me.
Marsha says she busks on the street every day from May to November. She plays for 2 hours at a time.
It's exciting and you meet people and people are dancing. It makes me feel like I'm doing something right.
On a good day, Marsha says, she makes more than $60 from busking. On a bad one, she might earn less than 10.
We'll see, the rich people don't give money. It's a poor bum who lives under the dock who'll give you the last quarter.
Marsha says she makes some of her best money in the fall, after most performers leave for the season. In the summer, Provincetown is a mecca for street performers. Musicians, mimes, human statues. Surprisingly, there aren't a lot of turf battles.
We play 2 hours. It's like the kind of code that we all know. 2 hours and then pass it on to somebody.
But Marsha has had to fight for her place on the street. In 2007, a local merchant started a petition to ban unnecessarily loud, excessive, or unusual noise. Marsha could have packed up and looked for gigs in local bars, but...
Not everybody goes to bars to hear music, and little kids can't go, and old people don't usually go either. And I think my music is suited for the street, because if I'm playing a blues club, I can't play my classical stuff. But, you know, if I'm on the street, I can play anything I want.
Busking in another city like Boston or New York just wasn't an option. Marsha's a 14th generation Cape Codder, and Provincetown is home. So she fought back. She wrote her own counter petition and spoke up at town hall. But it wasn't enough. That summer, Provincetown passed a noise bylaw. It was a tough time for Marsha. The local paper printed a comic making fun of her as a clueless hippie. And to make matters worse, she started getting ticketed by police officers.
I was afraid to come out in the street and play very much, so I started cleaning houses with a friend, and then my wrist started getting sore. And it was terrible. I call it the summer of hate as opposed to the summer of love.
Eventually, Marsha found a lawyer to take on the case pro bono. He argued that busking is free speech, and in August of 2007, the bylaw was removed. The town waived Marsha's tickets, and she went back to the street. For Marsha, playing on the street is about connecting with people.
A couple of years ago, there was a busker, and I said, you know, you're not looking at the people. You're looking down, or you're just playing for yourself. You got your eyes closed, but people want to be looked at.
Marsha's obvious warmth earns her compliments and cash, but she doesn't make quite enough from busking to eke out a living. So she has a small side business, selling glass ornaments and perfume bottles.
It's all right for a second job, but I'm in a lonely garage and, you know, I'm just sitting there. The music is definitely the first.
When it gets too cold and empty for Marcia to play in Provincetown, she spends time recording CDs in London. While she's here, though, she's focused on bringing music and joy to the street.
I'm just, like, so blessed to have the talent that make people happy. And because all my life, that's been the theme of my life, has been music. And now it's, like, to the point where I can just actually do it. And I love it. And so happy what I do.
For WCAI's Creative Life, I'm Mallory Falk.
Vincent van Gogh, William Blake, Edgar Allan Poe, all beloved artists, all died penniless. When Word of Mouth continues, we ponder this question. What if other professions were paid like artists? First, the news.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. Imagine a surgeon spending years operating for free in hopes that the good exposure brings in business down the road. Or a college professor placing an open suitcase at the front of the class, hoping to get tips from students after each lecture. Absurd as it may seem, artists are routinely expected to scrape by on financial models that few other professionals would or could embrace. Michelle Aldridge is the creator of the arts website Guarlingo, where she recently wrote a meditation of sorts on the relationship between creativity and cash. It's called If Other Professions Were Paid Like Artists. Here she is speaking with Virginia Prescott.
Now, you write about an artist and a friend who felt that maybe she was being taken advantage of by the people closest to her. Can you tell us that story?
I can. This was a Facebook post that she did, and it was just mid-February, and she's a professional artist and graphic designer, and she decided to count up how many times she'd been asked to do something for free. And just 6 weeks into the year, she had already been asked 8 times, which is, you know, it's more than once a week. So it raised an important question in my mind. Is it ever okay for professional artists to give work away for nothing? And I'm not talking about hobbyists or giving gifts or doing trades, but professionals, you know, giving away their work. And often it's arts organizations and museums who are some of the worst offenders.
Is that who was asking her?
Yes, it was. Mostly museums and some arts organizations. And that just raised some red flags for me. It's not always arts organizations, though. There was this great article this week in Adweek about Dan Cassaro, and he was one of several graphic designers who got an email from Showtime asking him to submit some free professional design work to a contest. And the grand prize was a trip to Vegas and the chance to have his work seen at the MGM Grand during a high-profile boxing match.
Mm-hmm, so?
And, so Cassaro published his email exchange on Twitter, and it's gone viral. And he totally shamed Showtime. And this is his reply. He said, "It is with great sadness that I must decline your enticing offer to work for you for free. I know that boxing matches in Las Vegas are extremely low-budget affairs, especially ones with Floyd Money Mayweather. My only hope is that you can scrape up a few dollars from the grassroots event. If that happens, you might consider using some of that money to compensate people for doing the thing they are professionally trained to do."
So a lot of artists have stories like this.
They do. It's right. Very, very common.
Why are artists much more likely to be taken advantage of, or maybe even more importantly, why are they letting themselves be taken advantage of?
That's a good question. I think it's complicated. There is some misperception that, you know, art is fun more than it's work. Making a living as a professional artist, it certainly isn't easy. And there are certainly those who don't rely on their creative work for income. So their relationship to their work might be different than someone who's struggling or starting out. And I just think it's time for artists to discuss this topic openly so we can assess the larger effects that this is having. You know, is it devaluing creative work as a whole? You would never walk into a doctor or dentist's office and ask them to donate their services. Mm. doctors may do pro bono work, but they have that luxury of having that choice. They're not struggling to pay their bills.
Well, even for established artists like musicians, for example, this is a big deal going on in the record industry, obviously. They're making records, making like pennies on royalties if they're played on Spotify or that kind of thing.
That's right. That's right. That has been that market reality has been a real tough thing for musicians. So artists are having to adjust. So on the one hand, it's much harder to get a good record deal with an indie label because music sales aren't what they used to be. That's mm-hmm. not where the bulk of the money is coming in. On the other hand, it's much easier for musicians to bypass gatekeepers like record labels and go directly to fans. Mm-hmm. So some people will pay money for a song. Others are simply going to listen to money for free. But the model shifted, so now bands and musicians are making most of their money from touring and merchandise.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you think there's a perception there are types of or fields of art that are more legitimate to be paying for? So for example, a craftsperson or a furniture maker, you know, producing a table for you deserves to be compensated more substantially, or at least deserves, you know, wouldn't be asked for a table for free like a video installation maker or maybe a painter.
That's right, because there are those materials. People can see the end product, what they're getting for their money. Of course, legitimate is a loaded word. Mm. We could spend a whole show on that topic. but your question gets to the larger issue of the value we place on various art forms as a culture. You know, as Americans, we place a high value on film and television, for example, a lower value on classical music and painting. So does art need to be useful like a table or accessible like television to be valuable? Well, no. But are we good at recognizing creative genius when it's right in front of us? You know, no, we get that wrong all the time. So artists like Vermeer or Cezanne die in obscurity and poverty.
And others had patrons, you know.
That's right.
How do you do it?
That's right.
I'm talking about the financial models by which artists get paid and are sometimes taken advantage of with Michelle Aldridge. She's a creator of the arts website Guarlingo, looks at a lot of different aspects of living as artists, and recently wrote about how artists get paid. Well, you, one of the things you acknowledge is that a lot of people bring a lot of personal baggage about the relationship between art and money into their career. So what are some of the most pervasive myths that you think artists carry about the value of their work?
Yes, good question. I think money is sort of a dirty word for artists. Not in the art world for certain, but with artists. And if money were most important to them, most of them would have, you know, chosen to be a stockbroker. Mm. But money's not inherently evil in and of itself. It allows for flexibility and freedom. So one major money myth is that money corrupts in and of itself and that somehow having it is going to make you, you know, less of an artist. Other myths, you know, pricing work so that your friends can afford it instead of pricing it for your ideal market, believing that giving work away for free will lead to being discovered. You know, it's a small chance. And also that pricing appropriately is a kind of selling out, that if you charge what your time and energy is worth, that somehow, you know, you're greedy or materialistic.
Well, let's talk about pricing for a minute, because I find that so interesting. You know, the art market is not born in a vacuum. No. There's a lot that goes into pricing. And I have it on very good authority, as in an artist who told me this, that what she's making, and I won't divulge what that is, but somebody just suggested her add an O to the end of that, and you will sell like hotcakes. And that has happened for her.
Wow,
so,
that's great.
You know, a $400 object becomes a $4,000 object, and it works for her. So, you know, what does pricing appropriately mean when the art market is all about what people will pay?
So whether it's an art or craft or creative service, I think you should price according to the market you want to be in versus the market you may be currently in, which could be, you know, selling to your friends or neighbors or something like that. You want to have aspirational pricing, if you will. And that doesn't mean, you know, being ridiculous, but like your friend adding a zero, there is a perception that if something costs more, it has more value. Mm-hmm. So pricing too cheaply can actually shoot you in the foot.
You talked about the concept of dirty money, and I've heard many artists, you know, people who are admired for their creativity, guided by their creativity, say they hate the business side and can't market themselves. Is this, Michelle, still an option in the world where there are fewer gatekeepers and you are selling yourself to the world?
That's right. I think that more artists need to think about the business side, and schools are terrible about this, art schools in particular. There are some organizations like Creative Capital who have workshops and various resources for artists to teach them the business side of the work. But you can't just make your work and expect people to find you. You know, attention to detail is very important. So that means a great website, your business cards, your artist statement, all of these things. These are things that I have helped some artists with. And as someone who writes about art, I am constantly appalled at some of the websites that I see that are, you know, out of date and just don't do the job. So these are things that artists need to pay attention to. And I think you can't be good at everything. So if you're not good at writing or web design, then find someone who is. And you could, you know, there are volunteers out there at centers who can help you, or maybe you could barter, you know, you could trade work. I've done that before. I've done a writing job in return for visual artwork. So there are ways to get that work done if you're not good at it yourself. So learn to ask for help.
So there are a number of forces, you know, from, you mentioned museums and arts organizations, but people, worthy causes asking artists to donate their work for free. What is the responsibility of the artist in this?
Learn to say no, or at least ask for some kind of compensation for your work. Remember that saying yes to a free job may mean not having time or energy for paying work later. Mm. On the other hand, the burden of responsibility also rests at the feet of these organizations and businesses who are exploiting artists to a degree. So if you take a charity auction event, for instance, odds are the caterer is getting paid, the bartender is probably getting paid, the company renting that space out to the organization is getting paid. So why not the artist too? And if not, just say no. It's a lesson we all need to learn, right?
That was Michelle Aldrich, creator and curator behind the arts blog Guarlingo, speaking with Virginia Prescott. You can find a link to Michelle's article, If Other Professions Were Paid Like Artists, at wordofmouthradio.org.
Everything is free now. That's what they say.
Currently, there are 3.2 million Girl Scouts across the U.S., but did you know that some of those Girl Scouts are, well, not really girls anymore? We'll hear from an adult Girl Scout after the break.
Someone hit the big score. They figured it out. They were gonna do it anyway. Even if it doesn't pay.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia Prescott. Known for its crafts, campfires, and cookies, the Girl Scouts of the USA has been around for over 100 years. Today, approximately 59 million American women were Girl Scouts at one point in their lives. But just because you hit your 20s doesn't mean you have to give it up. Word of Mouth intern Molly Donahue brings us this story.
I have a confession to make. It's nothing people close to me don't already know. It even features on my resume. I'm an adult Girl Scout. I know, it's an oxymoron, kind of like jumbo shrimp. Believe me, anything you have to say, I've heard it. I've gotten the confused looks, and like many other adult Girl Scouts, I've fielded the burning questions.
What's the first question people ask you when they find out you're a Girl Scout?
Usually something along with the line of cookies.
That is, when people even find out.
I don't actively hide it, it just never comes up.
Right.
I think it's because people don't really know about adult Girl Scouts, so it's just something that isn't really well known.
So now you're asking yourself, what is an adult Girl Scout? I tracked down some of my troop mates to see what they thought.
You are an adult Girl Scout.
Yes, I am.
So can you explain what that means in your conception of it?
Well, I got a certificate, so I would assume that, like,
if other Girl Scout troops needed something, they could come to us.
I have a card in my wallet. That's a lifetime member card.
I didn't realize we had a card, but...
You didn't get a card?
An adult Girl Scout is technically somebody that has paid their dues, and we get the emails. We don't really do anything anymore, but we still get together sometimes.
Okay, so that's our understanding. Here's the official line on Girl Scouts of the USA.
When you become a Girl Scout adult, you join nearly 1 million Girl Scouts across the country and around the world who volunteer their time and inspire girls to become leaders. Whether you want to build your resume, blaze a particular career path, or make new friends based on a shared Girl Scout experience, you've got a worldwide sisterhood to add richness and fun for the rest of your life.
That's right. For the rest of my life. Steph mentioned that we've paid our dues, and believe me, we have. We've secured a lifetime of Girl Scout membership through years of crafts and sleepovers, campfires, and small-town events. The majority of our lives have been spent with this thing. Katie did the math.
So, I want to say I started in 1998. So, I think I was 5. So, technically, 21, 5... So 16 years Girl Scout now. Yep.
And most important, though, respect for the organization is best expressed one way. Cookie money. Actually, Steph's cookie money.
You are a cookie queen.
I am a cookie queen.
On average, how many boxes of cookies a year did you sell?
Around 350.
God, Steph blew us out of the water with those cookie sales, though. I wouldn't put it past her if she, like, sat there with a phone book and went through, like, all...
She was clearly the best saleswoman in the troop, but cookies are central to being a Girl Scout.
That's why I did Girl Scouts. I mean, that's why I stuck with it for so long, because I had some faithful cookie buyers. But, yeah, I mean, like, when you think of Girl Scouts, that's all you think of is the cookies, and, like, that's the coolest part of it, so...
So we have Thin Mints.
Classic.
Samoas.
Amazing.
Did you know Samoas also go by the name Caramel Delights?
In different states.
Yeah.
Yes.
Tagalongs.
Peanut buttery goodness.
Then we have trefoils.
Shortbread. Yep.
But as any good Girl Scout will tell you, it does go beyond cookies.
I feel like because all of us were so different, we might not have been as close as we were if we hadn't been in Girl Scouts.
Girl Scouts. As a child, super awesome. As a preteen, super embarrassing. As a teenager, still, you know, a little embarrassing. And as a adult, super awesome. Tell all my friends all the time.
That's probably the best way you could have ever ended that. Thank you.
We all agreed. Being an adult Girl Scout isn't something you flaunt. But it isn't something we're trying to hide either. After all, we're in this for life. For Word of Mouth, this is Molly Donahue.
While the Girl Scouts rely on cookies as a source of revenue, the ALS Association has found an equally novel approach to fundraising. Yes, of course, I'm talking about the Ice Bucket Challenge. As of yesterday, Ice Bucket donations totaled $88.5 million. But our next story isn't about the fundraising model. Rather, it's about the contents of those buckets. Because not all ice is created equal. When you order a fancy cocktail made with fresh-squeezed juices and infused liquors, do you really want to drink it with cloudy lumps of ice that came out of a nozzle? Yes, we are indeed entering the age of artisanal ice. Camper English wrote Freezer Harvest, A History of Ice Cubes for ModernFarmer.com, and he joined Virginia to talk about unexpected variations on the ice cube.
The South is known for its mint juleps and pimp's cups and, of course, the Caribbean daiquiris and mojitos and other cold cocktails. Apparently, we have an American entrepreneur to thank for all those. Who is it?
That's Frederick Tudor, the man who more or less created the ice industry. He came up with the idea to harvest pond ice from lakes and ponds around New England and to export it around the world to as far away as India from Massachusetts.
When was he doing this?
We started around 1800, and from 1800 to around 1830, was the buildup of the ice industry as it came to be. And that changed everything, not just in cocktails, but with refrigeration. It really brought new technology to the world.
Well, I'm thinking ice harvesting. These are these big, giant blocks of ice that are getting shipped around and kept in ice houses and cold boxes. Where did the ice cube come from?
Well, the cube came when you would break down these big blocks originally and into smaller bits usable in drinks or for cooling in general. So you mentioned the julep before. Julep would be made from the shavings that came off of a big block, perhaps when you were sewing up a larger block into smaller ones, and you have all that shaved or crushed ice, we would say. That's the right ice for a julep, and that's pretty much how the julep came about.
So today, when a bartender asks if you want to drink straight up or on the rocks, back then it was actually the composition of the ice that was crucial to the cocktail.
Yeah, there was a lot of different sizes of ice for different types of drinks. Old cocktail books would specify one or two lumps of ice. Mm-hmm. I don't think we have lumps very often from commercial ice machines. But
well, yeah, that is so interesting. But did they not mix drinks before the ice cube?
Well, they absolutely mixed drinks and cocktails before ice became popular in drinks, but the early recipes would say water instead of today we would always say ice. So the original definition for the cocktail from 1806 is when it was first defined in America was a concoction of spirits, sugar, bitters, and water. And today we would say ice.
Mm. Well, now that classic cocktails are really in vogue, how strictly are bartenders adhering to the recipes, which sometimes actually call for different kinds of authentic ice?
Well, it's really fun in a lot of places. Like there's a bar drink in Boston where they have a great big block of ice on the back bar. And if you want a julep or a cobbler, they will chop off a big piece and put it in a bag and smash it with a mallet to get it to the size of the appropriate size ice for the drink that you have ordered. So it gets pretty nerdy. And also people are insisting on a clarity in their ice for great big clear ice cubes that you can't really make at your home refrigerator.
How are people getting these big huge blocks of ice?
For the most part, people order them from ice companies, and these ice companies use a type of machine that produces blocks for ice sculptures. And those, the way they're able to freeze clear is by using running water, so there's no pockets for the air trapped within the water to freeze and make the cloudiness in the ice.
So could we conceivably make clear ice like this at home?
There is a way, and it's a way that I helped, I don't know, promote and develop. And it's a really simple way, but it takes up a lot of space in your freezer. If you take a hard-sided picnic cooler, like an igloo lunch cooler, and fill that with water, leave the lid off, and put it in your freezer, the ice now will freeze only from the top down because all the other sides are insulated. And this will push any trapped air and impurities towards the bottom as it freezes, because ice would prefer to be clear if given the choice. And so the first part of the ice that freezes will all be perfectly clear, and only the bottom in this cooler would be cloudy. So you can either let it freeze all the way and chop off the cloudy bottom, or you can just not let it freeze all the way and have a perfectly clear big slab of ice, which then you'll need to use some new ice pick skills to cut it down into the size of cubes that will fit your glass.
Camper English there, talking with Virginia about his article for Modern Farmer, Freezer Harvest, A History of Ice Cubes. If you'd like to see what artisanal ice looks like, there's a slideshow on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And I'm going to tell you right now, it is weirdly mesmerizing. Listen, ice is back with my brand new invention, something. Thank you so much for joining us today. Earlier in the show, we spoke with Jessica Leahy, she's an educator and contributing writer for The Atlantic, about the debate over school start times. The American Academy of Pediatrics just released a new policy statement claiming a later start time could improve sleeping patterns and grades for middle and high school students. We asked Jessica's son, Finnegan, to weigh in on the issue. And what time does school start for you, Finnegan?
You're supposed to be there by 8.
Okay, would you like that to be 8:30? Do you think that would be a good thing?
It would be. I'm all for it, and it would be a lot better.
Why is that?
It's it's a little frustrating having to be, you know, got up at that time.
So that's a fifth grader's take on the debate. We'd love to hear from you as well. What time do your kids have to catch the bus to make it to school on time? Do you support a later start time for your kids? Join the conversation already happening on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia Prescott. Join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio. 5.0 with my rag top down so my hair can glow. Keep my composure.